Michael Boyd, Artistic Director of the RSC, thank you very much indeed for finding the time to talk to Theatre Voice. This week has seen an amazing number of happenings at the RSC. There's been the opening in Stratford of Othello and the London transfer of All's Well That Ends Well. The state of the RSC, much talked about in the press, is not something we're going to be particularly addressing this afternoon. We're going to be concentrating in the main on tragedy, and in particular the tragedy season that's coming up at the RSC. There's a whole batch of work, Romeo and Juliet, King Lear, Hamlet and Macbeth. And I think the starting point really for this conversation has to be, we expect the RSC to put on Shakespeare's tragedies, but we don't necessarily automatically assume that they'll be put on in one fell swoop. So I wonder whether you could outline why you decided to do this.
Partly because we can. Because it's the sort of project that the RSC is better placed probably than any other company in the world to do. For one group of people, one big artistic team to take on a project of real ambition and scale, it's easier for us to aspire to that than probably for anyone else, because of the way we're shaped, because of our nature as an ensemble company, because of the length of our engagement with the artists, and increasingly in terms of the work that we're doing now, the depth of our engagement with them in terms of their development and the training and the extra time for inquiry that we're building into the working process. But not just because we can. I suppose the decisions were being made in the build-up to the in the penumbra of our latest war. They were being made, the decision to do it was being made while reading newspapers that constantly used the word tragedy in its prose, but not really in a very meaningful way. We conversationally and in journalese use the words tragic and tragedy, but they don't really mean very much. And yet also in that same paper and on the website and on the television, we find it harder to escape from the grief of individuals who have lost their two children, or the starvation of an entire population, or a story of extraordinary corruption in power. Telecommunications mean that we do live in an anxious age where we're faced with crises, an enormous amount, everyone. I remember being really shocked the other day watching Teletubbies with my daughter, and straight after it came the 1 o'clock news that really was not particularly censored. And there's a juxtaposition of our private individual lives with public grief that I don't think we particularly know how to handle. And I don't think the church is able to help us as much as it used to. And I think that tragedy is a great tool for helping us. I think there's also an anxiety about mortality. With every new medical advance, with every pilot project on a cancer-killing bug, we become more anxious about our life expectancy. We don't become less. Being able to, you know, quite a lot of us live to 80 as opposed to maybe 70. It doesn't make us any the less anxious. We're still tortured, I think, by the fact that we love life, and we are born with those sort of Hamletian aspirations to the spiritual and notions of immortality, and the juxtaposition of that with the absolute certainty that we're going to die. It's very difficult. That's always been difficult. I don't know that we live in a particularly acute mortality crisis at the moment, but it doesn't seem to me any less acute, and maybe it is slightly more acute because of medical advances.
To play devil's advocate for a second, I mean, I suppose we've become used in the theatre world to looking to institutions like the Royal Court, for example, to react perhaps to these kinds of anxieties, these kinds of concerns, you know, whether it be problems in the political state or questions about even, I don't know, breakthroughs in technology, which we're inclined to worry about. The place of Shakespeare in the modern dilemmas that you've referred to then is one that I just wanted to elaborate on a bit further, because one could straight away argue, I suppose, that Shakespeare has this automatic anachronism in that he's writing about, primarily in his tragedies, about men of a certain class, of a certain estate, high degree. And we're so used to approaching things, as you mentioned, on television through democratic channels, looking at the ordinary suffering. Do you think that Shakespeare then has to be modified in some way in order to fit in with those perceptions of what constitutes a tragic victim?
Well, all power is relative. And there's a whole range in any of Shakespeare's tragedy of the powerful and the dispossessed. So you've got those ranges. Now, what social class they fall within and who gets most lines. You know, it generally tends to be fairly powerful people that get most lines. You could say that the canon of new work since the war has slightly failed us in terms of a thorough examination of the nature of power and the powerful, because quite rightly the dramaturgy has turned, the urgency has been felt to be to giving a voice to the dispossessed, to the less well off, to the people, to the voters, and that has been absolutely right. That was what needed to happen. I think now, as we are right, our noses are up against the problem that we don't trust our leaders, I think we need a thoroughgoing moral and spiritual examination of leadership, of power, of those who are ruling over us. I think a dramaturgy of the powerful is urgent again, and obviously, Shakespeare is useful in that respect. And I think there is something that's interesting about the powerful in society, in that they represent the moral crisis that occurs when you move from the private world of the individual into the more political or the more universal, whether it's the sort of proverbial power corrupting and absolute power corrupting absolutely, or whether it's simply that moment when an individual with their life, with their family, with their job, with their occupations, stretches their capacity as a person to the point where supposedly they're supposed to understand what the proper life of a nation ought to be, what proper decisions a nation should make. That join is a very dodgy one at the moment, and I guess it's always going to be one of moral crisis. How do we agree with each other? How do we achieve consensus? How do we live better together? I think Shakespeare's tragedies are intensely political in that sense. They're an examination of how we fail to rise above our private urges, those recognisable, intimate things, to, let alone being demigods or immortals, just sociable beings. How do we do that? It's not easy, because people disagree, and some people are stronger than other in different ways. And because we do have the capacity to do wrong and to wound and to hurt and to damage and be destructive and indeed be self-destructive. And there's a particular crux of the meeting of the individual, of the private and the public, meeting of the individual with the social, that is covered in the tragedies, in the powerful people and in the people who feel they should be more powerful and in the people who are the victims indeed of power. And where tragedy really creeps under our radar and grabs us is when it has that sense of inevitability about it, when actually it's not, you know, Ophelia is not simply a victim of someone's oppression. She is caught in a web of humanity that includes misogyny, it includes arranged marriage and women as dynastic property, it includes a coup d'etat, it includes patriarchy, it includes, on a more private level, being in a relationship with someone under insupportable pressure. Now, when you see a perfectly capable, strong individual caught up in all of that, you are awoken as a member of the audience to our vulnerability in an extraordinarily compassionate way, I think, by Shakespeare. But it's not easy just to point the finger at what kills Ophelia. Shakespeare doesn't underestimate the complexity and depth of the forces that bring her to drown. And I think that's when tragedy is at its best.
Well, it's fascinating that you're talking about, as it were, the power plays in Shakespeare, the tragic power plays, and that disjunction almost between those private urges and those public requirements. And it was interesting that you really began your tenure with, in a way, plays about victims almost, that Pericles and Tithes Andronicus preceded this onslaught of the major tragedies. I just wonder whether that was quite intentional in some ways.
No. Tithes Andronicus we hadn't done on stage, on the main stage, for such a long time, and I just felt that it would have the sort of freshness of doing a new play if we could give it that large voice on the main stage. And we had a lovely actor in David Bradley who wanted to play the part, and Pericles is absolutely a move on from the full-scale production of Pericles that we did in the Roundhouse under Adrian's tenure, and it was originally conceived that the two productions would run in parallel, and it's just a historic accident that they ran out of sync. Although certainly I very much enjoyed with Pericles the juxtaposition. It could have been awkward, but it wasn't. The juxtaposition of contemporary stories of displaced asylum seekers and the displaced Pericles and his daughter. I thought that was very strong. And yes, although it's a late play that follows on from the tragedies, in many ways it's a good tributary to the tragedy season, but by accident.
It will be noted, I suppose, given these thoughts that circulate around the season, that Nicholas Heitner began the National with a clearly contemporary reading of Henry V, and I wondered whether without necessarily having to give a huge amount of detail away, whether these particular productions are looking for looking to strike very direct kind of contemporary resonances, or whether that's not necessarily a stipulation of the way they're being organised.
I think there's many a way of striking a contemporary resonance. I don't necessarily think that by setting something in any particular era or period that you're necessarily, I mean, superficially, of course, you're striking a contemporary resonance because they're dressed in recognisable clothes, but that's not that doesn't necessarily mean it's profoundly resonant for now. No, I think we're trusting in the themes of the plays to do that. Different directors, there are four different directors working on the different tragedies with the same company of actors, and I think we'll just find out what each different director, how each different director responds. I think it will be the audience in a way that will pick up the accumulated effect of the season as they go through the pieces. And the actors. You're asking actors to go down quite a serious journey of political inquiry, of self-inquiry, to get these plays right. But no, we're not. We're inviting the audience to see the contemporary resonance rather than flagging it up.
It's often said that Shakespeare wrote tragedies. We can't talk necessarily in terms of a Shakespearean tragedy. I know this is a very general question, but is there something that one could talk about overall that characterises Shakespearean tragedy, do you think?
You talked about Titus Andronicus. That seems... Titus Andronicus in many ways is less Shakespearean than the tragedies that we think we know and love, and I think that's because it belongs more closely to Roman tragedy. It's very, very closely following in the footsteps of Seneca, with a young Shakespeare, keen to impress, keen to get a good house with lots of blood and gore, but already exploring some of his major themes. But slightly a slave to Roman voyeurism. You can admire it for its courageous objectivity, its unflinching Tarantino objectivity. There is the danger with classic Shakespearean tragedy, badly performed, that it is compassionate to the point of sentimentality compared to Tarantino or Titus Andronicus. but I can't help feeling that it's more courageous to show the cost to the victim and to explore their emotions. I don't think Shakespeare's showing pity. I think he's rather trying to dramatise something pitiful. Something I feel in spirit, in a way, Shakespeare instinctively, because I don't think it's probably I don't think it's due to a great knowledge of Greek tragedy, but he seems to get closer to the spirit of Greek tragedy. There is more of a dialogue with the gods, with natural forces, and more of an interest in the possibilities of society in Shakespearean tragedy and in Greek tragedy than there is in Roman tragedy. Roman tragedy is so concerned with the sort of schadenfreude of the downfall of man, and with a pessimism, a profound, unshakable pessimism, which I think says something about the period of the Roman Empire when Roman tragedy was at its height with Seneca. I think Shakespeare's, what's extraordinary about Shakespeare's work in the comedies as well as the tragedies is the way it sits in between great joie de vivre and unflinching, sort of an unflinching Beckettian eye on the truth of our mortality, and all that that means, getting older and dying, being vulnerable. But it's not an unremitting, rather neat, diagrammatical, stoical, pessimistic view. I like his untidiness. We all do, actually. That's one of the things that we really do like about Shakespeare, is that he doesn't fit neat formulae, and that is a distinct feature of his tragedies, I think.
But there was an interesting article in the Guardian this week, in which the writer talked about responses to tragedy, actually crying, being overwhelmed by tears watching Shakespeare. And it may seem like a crass question, but what do you expect audiences in this day and age to do when confronted with a Shakespearean tragedy? We're quite familiar with these texts from school onwards. We know what's going to happen. We know what will arise. Do you think there's a way in which a director can actually create pity and terror? I mean, what Aristotle called pity and terror.
Yes, I think you can. Especially, it's much easier in a small, tiny little claustrophobic studio theatre. You can do terrible things to your audience. There are pornographic ways in which you can evoke appalling responses in audience. I remember being at one show. It was a contemporary, very, very awful story of a Jewish theatre group in Germany, and it was very powerful. I don't know whether I would call it tragic now that I'm actually doing a tragedy season, but it was a very powerful and moving story, and the production at the end brought down a screen and projected images of piles of spectacles, piles of human hair, piles of shoes, and dreadful images of starving people, and I was very angry at having my buttons being pressed in a I thought a pornographic way. The people mounting that wanted to produce an effect in me, and they took a shortcut. And actually, I think in some members of the audience were very, very moved, just like some people are very, very turned on by certain magazines, and that's not good tragedy. So I suppose I'm answering your question by saying I don't try and think about a response that I want to provoke or bring up. And I'm not sure that Shakespeare does either, actually, as a writer. I think what he's trying to do is sort of tell the truth to save his soul. He's to work out how to live. He's imaginatively putting himself in the tragedies in impossibly tight, but very recognisably tight situations, and testing his own humanity out in all its different guises as all the different characters, and hoping through putting himself through that ringer that he will end up knowing a little bit more about how to live better. And I suppose, in the end, that's the best of all possible responses from the audience as well. That you do go through the ringer, and for different people that will mean different things. It'll mean a tightness in the chest to some, a sweaty palm for others, and tears for yet more. But that's not, it's not that physiological response that's important. What's important is that there's a proper spiritual journey, I suppose, gone on. And maybe intellectual journey as well, a political journey. That is for the better.
One very quick question, because it seems unfair to leave them out, which is these plays by Zinnie Harris and Joanna Lawrence, which are being billed as mini-tragedies. I mean, these are plays that have been called mini-tragedies as part of the season. And that seemed very audacious, in a way, to reclaim the word tragedy for a modern play, because we're so used to talking about a new play, full stop, without actually giving it some kind of weight, as though it's arrogant or presumptuous to call it a tragedy. Is this something that... do you think they are particularly different kinds of plays, or is it that you're trying to reassert the genre of tragedy in a modern context, anyway?
I think we're asking the question, why don't people refer to themselves as writing tragedy now? It's fascinating that right now there's a play on at the Almeida that has a subtitle, Notes Towards the Definition of Tragedy, Albee's Goat play. It seems to be maybe resurfacing. Philip Roth's last four novels, I think, are very much notes towards a redefinition of tragedy. Is it a form whose time has come again? It seems to have, if you like, gone out of fashion. Maybe it's time for it to come back into fashion.
Well, I'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much, Michael Boyd.
Thank you.
Thank you.